You're listening to the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. Journalist John Nichols is here this hour, and we will talk about his new book, Horsemen of the Trumpocalypse, a field guide to the most dangerous people in America. John says that President Trump is surrounding himself with the wrong kind of people. He says that the president's team has the power to change America and not for the better. And he calls this administration the most dangerous cabinet ever. So what do you think? Maybe you agree with him. Maybe you don't. Maybe you think President Trump is draining the swamp. Or maybe you think he's filling it. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. John Nichols is the associate editor for the Capital Times and a veteran political writer for The Nation. He joins us in the studio. Good morning.
Good morning. It's great to be with you.
It's good to have you here. So this is a book about President Trump's cabinet, and you started it, in the summer, and it just is out, and things have changed already.
Of course, things will change, and actually, the roots of this book come from February of 2016, and I wrote a cover story for The Nation, and the title was President Trump, It Could Happen, and I argued that a lot of the economic and social changes that had occurred in the last 20, 25 years pointed to a real rupture in our politics. There's a good chance that something would change. It didn't say that Trump would happen, so I don't take that credit for seeing all things. But it held out the possibility. And because I covered Trump on the campaign trail, as well as all the other candidates, I became very conscious early on that he was entirely incapable of forming a cabinet. Wasn't that he was some people like to dismiss him as stupid or incompetent in all sorts of ways. That wasn't my point. It is, to form a cabinet, you have to have some experience in government. You have to know your way around. The notion that you can come in from the outside and just, cobble together, bring a bunch of friends along. It's been tried a few times. It's been disastrous historically. It's just not how it works. And it doesn't work. It doesn't function well. So I knew that he was going to turn to others. And I was interested in who he would surround himself with and how power would be distributed. And so I started looking very early on at it and piecing all these things together. But then once he was elected, I focused a great deal of attention on that actual process by which he chose people for these incredibly powerful positions. And that's the second part of it, that it's important to understand the cabinet isn't what people are taught about in, civics class anymore. George Washington had four cabinet people. We make Broadway plays about him. We know who they are. Now the cabinet is huge. Even presidents struggle to remember who they have put into what positions. And the power that is afforded to these departments, not merely through budgeting, and they have huge budgets, and through staff, some of them have tens of thousands of employees, but also the areas that they have responsibility for and their ability to through executive orders, through internal orders, to guide governance without much oversight from Congress, is so immense that it just occurred to me that we really need to examine where this power went. And what struck me as it came together was that we saw the worst of Donald Trump. It was him as the host of The Apprentice, inviting people in, looking for who shouted loudest, who made the most noise, and then giving these people immense power with very little congressional oversight, as I said, but also very little presidential oversight.
Well, it seemed to me at the time that a lot of the picks were people who were going to do the opposite of what the Obama administration did.
Oh, it's more than that. No, yes, I agree. Yeah. Obviously, it's a fascinating thing about Donald Trump. In a transition election where you were going to choose a new president, not re-elect or refuse to re-elect a president, Donald Trump chose very much to run against his predecessor. And that's not unheard of in politics, but it is an interesting thing. And you're right. There is that element of it. Undo Obama. And we could talk about some of the bizarre lengths they've gone to do that.
But it was also that he would pick somebody to head a department when they wanted to abolish that department.
That's the key. Yeah, I think that's much more it, that second component, which is that many of these people literally make lies of the names of their department. Scott Pruitt, who has spent decades attacking the environmental protection administration agency, and who's now administrator there, and who sued the EPA regularly over the years, literally set up his own political operations to attack it, is now in charge of it. And what he's doing is very antithetical to the basic constructs of it under Republicans or Democrats, under conservatives or liberals. The same goes with someone like Jeff Sessions. This is a guy who Republicans in the United States Senate rejected to be a judge back in the 1980s because he was seen as being antithetical to justice. He was a guy who wasn't on the right side of history. Now he's running the Department of Justice, and you can go department by department and see this play out of something that Steve Bannon talked about in one of his better interviews back in, I think it was February, where he said, really, the point of this whole thing is the deconstruction of the administrative state, i.e. taking all these things apart in a way that then centers immense amounts of power in political appointees rather than, you know, long-term experienced people. And also that makes, instead of an administrative state that runs things, that manages, that helps to, you know, proceed from a beginning long before, you make the break, and much of that administration no longer functions. Yeah. And so this is a big deal. This is a book about a transition point in our history as much as just a presidency.
Since you mentioned Steve Bannon, and a lot of the administration has seen a lot of turnover. Steve Bannon's gone, Michael Flynn is gone, Reince Priebus is gone, Sean Spicer is gone. Why is that?
Oh, well, first off, Flynn was out so quick that he didn't even make the book. Some of these people, you know, some people who have gone are in the book, folks like Bannon. Mm-hmm. It's my argument that that many of the people who are seen as outside of the administration are actually now in sort of a oddly integrated relationship with the administration. They may not have a title, but they're very influential, and perhaps even more influential than when they had a title. So that's one of the reasons why this is a book not merely about cabinet members and appointees, but also advisors, allies, funders, a whole host of folks. Now, as regards transition within the Trump world, this is one of the things I studied when I was working on the book, and it's a fascinating thing. Donald Trump brings people into his world. This goes back to his business and his entertainment experience. And then he fires them, right? He pushes them out. But the fascinating thing is, if you watch The Apprentice, which is the greatest instruction for understanding this administration, not kidding. If you watch The Apprentice, he would fire somebody, and then the next season or season later, they're back. And the way to understand Trump is he likes to shuffle people, but he's not very good at expanding his circle. So one of the things is that as regards the book, 95% of the people in the book are in exactly the position that he put them in, and they will be, many of them, especially the cabinet folks, for a long time. There will be some people who shuffle, but I counsel, be very, very careful of assuming that an exit from the White House means that you are gone. It's just not how Donald Trump works. And in fact, if you look at the case of Steve Bannon, there is simply no question. He is more influential today than he was a month ago, because now outside, with Breitbart behind him, with the Mercers, people I write about in the book, very wealthy financiers who are both strong supporters of the administration but also very strong supporters of Bannon funding what he does, the simple fact of the matter is he'll continue to influence this administration. And as he has said, he'll be there for the president, but he won't necessarily be there for other Republicans. And
yeah, he's going to primary Republicans is what he's saying now.
And he'll create a pressure on the president that seeks to move Trump in certain ways to reinforce certain Trump instincts and values. This is very much like what you saw in the 1930s with Franklin Roosevelt. There were people who were inside Roosevelt's administration, but there were also people who were outside but very influential. And there was a struggle because what Roosevelt was doing in the 30s was so immense, so transformational, that there are people who tried to steer the train in this direction, tried to steer it in that direction. I would argue the Trump presidency, whether you like it or not, is so immense and so transformational, or potentially so, that you will see these inside-outside players throughout it.
John, we just have a minute before a news break, and then lots more time after that, but were you surprised to see Reince Priebus go? I know you know Reince Priebus.
A little. I don't know him as well as I'd like. I mean, he's a good Wisconsinite, or at least a Wisconsinite. I was not surprised at all. He was brought in. He's one of these people, and there are many people like this in the Trump administration who are folks who were loyal to him during late stages of the campaign. That meant a lot to Trump, and so he gave them positions of great power. But he didn't know them. They didn't fit. Priebus did not fit Trump's style. And the fact of the matter is, Priebus, hidden thought or a little subtlety of it, Priebus actually worked quite well with Steve Bannon. They thought they'd be at clash. In fact, they both wanted this thing to succeed, and they worked well together. But no, I'm not surprised that he's gone. But I would be surprised if he doesn't end up with something else.
We will check news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio, and then we'll continue talking with John Nichols, author of Horsemen of the Trumpocalypse, a field guide to the most dangerous people in America. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine, talking with journalist and author John Nichols this hour about his new book, Horsemen of the Trumpocalypse, a field guide to the most dangerous people in America. And we wonder if you think that Trump has assembled the most dangerous cabinet ever, if you think that the advisors and cabinet members and other appointees that President Trump has put together is dangerous. 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. So, John, Trumpocalypse, what in the world? I had to practice that several times. Why did you call it? What is the Trumpocalypse?
Well, I have to tell you a story. In touring for the book, we've been a lot all over the country. And at Politics and Prose, which is the great bookstore in Washington, we had a wonderful event. People, it was very crowded, and the C-SPAN was there, all this good stuff. And the person who was introducing me said, oh, I got this. I've been working on the title. I got it nailed. It was the first time I'd ever thought that the title was hard. It had never occurred to me that this was going to be a challenge. And he went out, and he really struggled with it. It was sort of a collapse of the word. And so one of the things I've learned is that we've created a new word, and it, not only do you have to learn how to pronounce it, you also have to learn how to define it. Look, it's rooted in obviously, the biblical concept of apocalypse, because so many people see Donald Trump, the man, in these incredibly dark and dangerous ways. And I don't tell them that they're wrong, but there's such an obsession with the notion that Trump has the nuclear codes, or Trump has his finger on the button, that we lose sight of the fact that Trump has empowered dozens of other people. I write about 42 different folks in the book, and many other subgroupings within. And what's absolutely clear is that Donald Trump could go to sleep today, like Rip Van Winkle, and sleep through the rest of his presidency, not tweet, not give a speech, you know, just relax, you know, maybe play some golf, I don't know. But we would still have a radical transformation of the United States because of the people he has empowered and the immense power that they have. And because they are often so radical, so extreme, so at odds, as we suggested before, with the departments that they lead, that we end up in a situation where at the finish of Trump's presidency, we could have had a incredibly radical transformation of the United States, a very, very different country than we imagined, and had it happen very softly, very much without our attention, in our name, but without our informed consent. And to my mind, that's why we all have to stop looking so much at Trump and start looking a little more at where the power has been distributed. Because if we don't, my sense is that the Trump presidency will be an immense success. And yet we'll comfort ourselves that Trump himself, Trump the man, was not so successful.
All right, well, what is the difference between President Trump said he was going to drain the swamp? Isn't that what he did?
No, quite the opposite. In fact, these really are swamp dwellers. And the fascinating thing about his cabinet and his circle of advisors is that financial power, largely, has been given over to people from Goldman Sachs. I've got a list in the book of all the Goldman Sachs people that are in or around this administration, and it's long. I mean, it's incredible. People like Gary Cohn and others, Steve Mnuchin at Treasury, and these people have a vision of a neoliberal, austerity-focused future for the United States of America. Their budget director, Mick Mulvaney, proposes, this is the official policy of the Trump administration, to literally move tens of millions of dollars out of domestic programs, things like Meals on Wheels, and give it to the Pentagon. And this is what I mean by a radical transformation of the United States. Many of the people who are in the administration now are generals who wanted the Pentagon to be much bigger, Wall Street folks who wanted rich people to be less taxed, and long-term militant activists for deconstruction of aspects of the federal government. So in environmental areas, we have folks who wanted less environmental protection. In education, we have Betsy DeVos, who literally has been at odds with our education system for a very long time. Don't begrudge her opinion, but recognize she isn't there to make public education work in America. She is there to radically transform it. And what I keep coming back to is, far from draining the swamp, Donald Trump took people who, A, had been in the swamp, very much the case in the financial areas, B, who'd been, you know, in positions of power before, very much the case in Pentagon and a lot of the military industrial complex areas, people coming out of Congress. He took a number of members of Congress and made them cabinet secretaries or put them in other positions. And C, people who have so little respect for their department. But they weren't like, they're not like rank outsiders who said, oh, take a look at this department, figure it out. No, no. There are people who are at war with that department. To sum it up, the person who is the Secretary of Energy of the United States of America, in charge of our nuclear waste, is a guy who, when he ran for president, said he wanted to eliminate the department but couldn't remember its name.
Famously, yes. You divide the book into different categories. Wicked messengers, privateers, the hacks, generals and CEOs searching for monsters to destroy. No chapter on true public servants or people fighting the good fight?
I think the guy over at Veterans Affairs is pretty good.
That's it?
No, it's very interesting. Look, there are some folks who are in this administration who might have been seen in previous administrations. I think it is possible that General Mattis, who is at the Pentagon, might have been seen in a previous administration. General McMaster over in the White House advising on national security, you might have seen in a previous administration. But most of these people, especially the cabinet, top of the cabinet post, they're way to the extreme of what you would have seen in a conservative Republican administration. And also, some of the people that you might have seen before, like a Mattis or a McMaster, in the writing of the book, I went back and read their books or read the things that they had done. And it's important to understand, they're often referred to as the adults in the room. But if our standard is adults in the room, my only counsel is I've been around adults. Not all of them are perfect. Just being an adult isn't sufficient. It's what you believe in, what you seek to do. And the people who've been put in charge of key Pentagon posts, Pentagon as well as, you know, some of these national security posts, are just passionate believers in a military-industrial complex. Not in some conspiratorial sense. They just really think the Pentagon should be much bigger, the preparation for war should be much greater. And the truth of the matter is that what we've created, especially on the as regards the generals and the some of the funding side of this, is exactly what Dwight Eisenhower warned us about. We literally have a tipping of the balance toward the Pentagon and toward contractors that work with the Pentagon and people around them that is far more extreme than we have seen at any time in recent, certainly since Eisenhower gave his warning.
John Nichols is our guest. He's the associate editor for the Capital Times. He writes for The Nation. You have heard him on Wisconsin Public Radio for many years talking about issues. You might see him also on MSNBC and the BBC. His latest book is Horsemen of the Trumpocalypse, and we are talking with him about why he thinks the cabinet and other appointees of President Trump are actually more troublesome, more dangerous than perhaps President Trump himself. And we wonder what you think, what questions you have. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Paul from Eau Claire emailed and he wonders, are you worried using the word Trumpocalypse and dangerous are encouraging political violence? like the attempted assassination of that Republican congressman a while back, or the Antifa riot mobs?
Well, look, we've had political violence in the United States, the primary and horrifying example being in Charlottesville, where the far-right neo-Nazis, fascists, supporters of the Confederacy, a political and military endeavor to defend slavery, were marching in the streets of an American city. In and around that, a young woman was killed. I am always concerned about these things. I don't for a second think the use of the word Trumpocalypse, which actually talks about something quite the opposite of these apocalyptic fears that people have on the right and sometimes on the left, but about a hidden, unnoted change in our politics, and arguing that our media and folks who are engaged in politics should pay attention to it. I don't think at all that that would encourage violence. I would certainly hope not. And also saying it's dangerous. Well, boy, if we have been reduced in our country to a point where we cannot identify that which is a danger, that which is threatening, then we've lost much more than just elections. We've lost the First Amendment to the Constitution in the United States. As a Quaker, a member of the Religious Society of Friends, I am a critic of violent solutions to any struggle. I don't see that as the way to go. It troubles me that because I think so often people are so unaware of what's really happening in our politics and in our governance, that there is this move toward not necessarily a violent response, but toward extreme responses. It's my view that knowledge of what's going on, paying attention to the real details, where the real power is, frees us to have a much more honest debate, and ideally a real debate. I've had people, it's interesting, on the book tour, I've had several incidents where people who voted for Donald Trump were at our events. And one of the things I do is ask the crowd to give them a round of applause, because I think it's courageous to stand up with a lot of folks who may not agree with you, and recognize that we have these differences. Another thing I've said is, this is healthy. It is healthy for us to come out, challenge one another, debate with one another. What I fear is where we stop talking to one another. So for our caller in Eau Claire, I think that books are not our problem. Newspapers are not our problem. Radio shows are not our problem. Discussion of the issues is not the problem. The problem is where so many things are done in our name but without our informed consent by very, very powerful people who we don't know much about.
President Trump and those close to him have called the mainstream media fake news, have called the media the enemy of the people. Others, supporters of Trump, say that the media is out to get him, that the media want to overthrow him. How do you assess the media and the job it's doing covering this administration?
Well, as you know from being on your show many times over many years, I think the media is doing a lousy job. I think that the lousy job began during the campaign. Trump was fascinating. He's an entertainer. He was given an incredible platform, and he used it very, very effectively to talk directly to people through and around the media. That was irresponsible. But much more irresponsible was the failure of most of the media to take Donald Trump seriously. Instead of sitting down with him and having serious conversations about issues, an awful lot of reporters were, trying to do the gotcha question about something he'd said or some behavior of his. And I respect coverage of that. But what I'm saying is, this is a guy competing for president of the United States. People should have talked to him about cabinet choices and things of that nature. And I think still, as president of the United States, I'm fascinated by how much of the coverage of him is gossip and, sort of, who does he like today or who did he have dinner with, rather than the core policy stuff. I'll give you what I think is one of the things I did in the book was, in almost every chapter, I highlight journalists that are doing it right. And there are journalists who are doing a fantastic job. The problem is that they're often doing serious journalism about the EPA, about the Department of Transportation, about these infrastructure proposals, which are really proposals for tax cuts for the rich, all these real issues that are in play. And they're often shunted to the back page if they make it in at all. Whereas Trump doing something horrible dominates coverage at this epic level. The classic example, to my mind, is the Charlottesville press conference, where Donald Trump said things that had to be covered. It was horrifying. It was awful that a president of the United States would, you know, struggle with the balance between racists and people who oppose racism, and talk about very fine people marching with fascists. That was an awful thing. However, it's notable that standing behind him at that press conference was Elaine Chao, the Secretary of Transportation. That was a press conference about infrastructure. It was a press conference at which the president and his Secretary of Transportation announced that they were overturning Obama-era rules, which one of which was the Federal Flood Risk Management Standard that said that future infrastructure had to be built to withstand storm surges and horrible flooding in hurricane-type situations.
And we didn't have any coverage of that.
No, that's what I'm saying. A week later, we're looking at Houston, 2 weeks later at Florida. And this is what I'm saying. To my mind, the Trumpocalypse is the quiet transformation of our rules, of our standards, in a way that none of us wants, but that because power has been distributed to people who really are focused on making big changes, those changes occur, again, in our name, but without our informed consent.
Let's take some calls. Marcello in West Lima, good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I just want to say that I think Trump is the best thing that's happened to the Progressive Party in 50 years. The pushback is enormous, and he's paving a way for Bernie-crats to come in and take over the whole system. More localized everything, because people are sick and tired of government, and he's the parody of the system as it's been. I'll take my my comments.
How do you react to that, John?
Well, West Lima in Lima in Richland County.
Is that where it is?
Yeah,
okay. I have not heard of that.
Well, this
Lima.
Is
okay.
You have been on forever.
Yeah, I know. And I know almost every burg, and I don't remember that
one. My favorite thing about this show and about what Wisconsin Public Radio is the callers and where they come from.
Yeah.
Because I love, and I don't always know, but my mom was born out by Boscobel, so I got some familiarity with those townships. But so what this caller is suggesting is, and I've had this interestingly on the tour going around the country, I've had people stand up and say, yeah, well, you see, Trump is making us realize how bad things are. And I would say it in a very different way. I think that Donald Trump's election and his governance reveals vulnerabilities in our political process and in our governing process that we should spend a lot of time thinking about. One of the vulnerabilities is, of course, the Electoral College, which allows a person who lost the popular vote to become president. I think that's something we should be talking about and paying attention to. But another vulnerability is what has happened with the power of the presidency. When someone becomes president of the United States, we focus entirely, almost entirely, on the individual. We say, wow, this man, or hopefully someday soon, this woman has taken this incredible position. And we focus so much attention. It's why Arthur Schlesinger Jr. referred to an imperial presidency. It's almost king-like. But what has also happened is that the administration around a president has grown into something unimaginable. Mm-hmm. It is so big. There is so much power. And what we lose sight of is a president can give power to individuals in cabinet posts, in advisory posts, all these different heading regulatory agencies where, for instance, at the FCC, you can transform communications in America.
We will talk more about this after we check news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. We are talking with John Nichols about his new book, Horsemen of the Trumpocalypse, A Field Guide to the Most Dangerous People in America. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network. And we welcome your questions and views for John at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. John's premise here is that that President Trump's cabinet and other appointees are more concerning than President Trump himself, and that maybe the media should be paying a little bit more attention to that than Trump's latest tweets. And we welcome your thoughts. I wanted to ask you about some current issues, though, in the news as well, John, especially when it comes to, for example, Attorney General Jeff Sessions in the news recently, because he and President Trump were at odds. We learned yesterday in a report from the New York Times that Trump was so upset that Sessions recused himself, which allowed a special investigator to be appointed in the Russia investigation, that he really wanted to fire Sessions, and that he wanted Sessions out. He called him an idiot and all sorts of things. Sessions reportedly sent a letter of resignation to Trump, but then Trump's aides convinced Trump that he should not fire Sessions. What's your reaction?
This is classic, and you're going to see stories like this for the next 3 years or as long as Trump is there. Donald Trump hires people so that he can beat up on them, right? He wants them to do their jobs. There's no question of that. But he's not a good boss. I mean, anybody who thinks he is, it's foolishness. It's an absurdity. He hires them so he can make them do what he wants them to do. Now, cabinet-level government is supposed to be empowering someone. A president names someone. Then, remember, the Congress confirms these people. Now, the U.S. Senate did a miserable job in the confirmation process. Confirmed people should never have gone to these positions in many cases. But still, once you're in the position, you're supposed to have some, you know, free will, some ability to define it, especially at Department of Justice. Now, here's the bottom line. Jeff Sessions is a horrible, horrible, horrible attorney general. He should not be in that position. He lied to the United States Congress during his own confirmation hearings, not once, but many times. That's been caught out, and he has not been held to account. And it's atrocious that he is continuing to serve there. However, Donald Trump can't get rid of him, because Jeff Sessions is and needs to be understood as one of the great power centers within this administration. He brings his own constituencies very much on the far right of immigration debates and a host of other debates. And if Trump were to fire Jeff Sessions, it would harm Trump. And that was the message delivered to him. Many people thought that it was, for instance, thought that it was Bannon saying, oh, yeah, you got to keep Sessions because I agree with Sessions or something like that. No, it was political counselors saying, boy, you know, you offend the people that like Jeff Sessions. You run the very real risk of weakening what, if the polls are correct, is a very small base. You know, Trump can't afford to offend those who actually are with him. And so you'll see this in a number of areas. The same is true of Scott Pruitt at EPA. He brings a constituency with him. Betsy DeVos at Education brings a constituency with her. Now, whether you agree with that constituency or not, what you must understand is that by empowering them, Donald Trump put people into positions who have agendas that are frankly stronger than his own and who will pursue those agendas. And failing to look at them, failing to follow what they're doing, just listening to what Donald Trump says, doesn't begin to tell you the whole of what is happening in these different areas of government.
Well, recently, Jeff Sessions, Attorney General Jeff Sessions, was the face of rescinding the DACA program, which deals with young adults who were brought into this mm-hmm. country by their parents as children and are here undocumented. So Sessions was, in essence, picked because of his anti-immigration
sure.
views.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, one of the things I write about in the book, and when you begin to look at Jeff Sessions, what you realize is he has been, for decades, at the center of efforts to divide the American people against themselves. In the 1980s, he arrested and charged voting rights activists, people who were literally registering people to vote, with crimes. His case was so absurd it was thrown out by a jury. But that was why he didn't get a judgeship back then. At a certain point in the 1990s, he sort of came back into politics and shifted his focus away from sort of that dead-ender fights over voting rights and things like that in the South, which, of course, have now come back into focus, to immigration. And it's interesting that some of his allies, well before Trump came along, were Steve Bannon over at Breitbart and Stephen Miller, who is a key presidential advisor to this day. And one of the things that I counsel people to do, and I write about in the book, is to look at these networks of connection. There are circles within the administration of people who have worked with each other for a very, very long time. And they are continuing to work down the tracks that they're focused on, no matter what Donald Trump is saying.
Yeah. Gosh, I have one more from the news. What do you make of Donald Trump working with Schumer and Pelosi over DACA? I mean, he seems like he's not being an ideologue there.
Yeah, I mean, actually, I don't think Donald Trump ever cared about it. I think DACA was something that he said horrible things about because that was part of this political act that he was in. What I would counsel is, it's great if they get him to move a little bit on DACA, which he should, and which Congress, I think, wants to, fantastic. But don't lie to yourself. Don't get into a fantasy that imagines that because that good thing is happening, nothing else bad could be going on out there. The fact of the matter is, horrible things are happening as regards immigrant rights at Homeland Security, in other agencies, in the Department of Justice as we speak. And if we get a little bit of movement in one area, the power that's been shifted to people who really are activists in other areas undoes it. Classic example is that you saw Congress refuse to go along with repeal and replace on getting rid of the Affordable Care Act. And yet what very few people have noticed is in recent weeks over at Health and Human Services, Tom Price has dramatically downsized support for signups for the Affordable Care Act. So Congress protects the Affordable Care Act, and then through this administrative state, you actually make it less functional.
Barry and Spooner is with us. Hi, Barry.
Hi.
Hey, Barry.
The reason I called in is I think your whole premise is wrong about the appointees. And you started with the EPA. And if you believe the EPA has gone above and beyond and gotten out of control from what it was designed to do, you need to bring in someone to rein it in. It's a philosophy, but it's not the apocalypse. If you think something is out of control, you have to rein it in. And that's a lot of what you're talking about is not something other than what you don't like.
Oh, it's a very interesting question, Barry, and I appreciate it very much. These agencies were created and are empowered by Congress via budgets and via legislation. And it is certainly acceptable if Congress were to come forward with legislation to say, yep, we really want to disempower the EPA. We want to change its focus. Maybe we want to eliminate it. I think that'd be a great debate. I'd be on one side. Maybe you'd be on the other. But that's not what we're talking about here. What we're talking about is a false premise. It is keeping the agency, keeping its budget, or at least some portion of it, and then putting somebody in charge who wants to deconstruct it or radically alter it, not working with Congress, not with proper oversight, but in fact just through quick orders and obsessions. In the case of Scott Pruitt, bizarre extremism on climate change, for instance. And people can debate climate change, but what's fascinating about it is that what Scott Pruitt has said since these hurricanes have hit in Texas and now in Florida is repeatedly, well, I don't want people talking about climate change here. He's literally using his platform to try and shut down a debate that scientists say we should be having about whether the warming of the planet is causing more intense storms, storm surges, more flooding. And look, this is absurd. And we see this in agency after agency. People who are not actually accepting proper congressional oversight, who are not being particularly public, but in fact are operating in secret. And then we also see the royalists, people like Mnuchin over at Treasury, who now we learn are trying to get government planes to fly them off on their honeymoons. I mean, this stuff needs to be examined. We need to be looking at these people and not see them just as bureaucrats. In many cases, they are plunderers and privateers. They are in charge of these agencies to make radical change, often to their own advantage.
We're almost out of time, but Brenda in New Berlin emailed, "With every pick, my whole extended family was more and more shocked and horrified with how each pick was specifically the most destructive, direct opposite, anti-side of what they were supposed to be protecting or covering. Are there really this many Americans who deny climate change, who deny diversity, who want to destroy our public lands, who want to surrender our national parks and monuments, destroy public education, health care, care for the elderly? All of these things are unacceptably, completely un-American to my family.
Maybe I should have just had her write the intro to the book, because that what she's saying is very close to what I believe. But also, it's my concern is that this reality, which Brenda recognizes, needs to be recognized by a lot more folks. Again, if you support Donald Trump and you support what these people are doing, that's fine. Enter the debate at that point. If you disagree, you need to be in that debate as well. But the bottom line is, we can't just talk forever about Donald Trump's tweets. At some point, we have to talk about what's happening at energy, at transportation, in the Department of Justice, at the EPA, and all these other agencies. If we don't, and we haven't even begun to discuss, you know, what's happening at the Department of State, which is, in my view, just a wholesale wrecking of the department. But we need to, as a society, because that's the way we actually keep track of government. Not just keeping track of the guy who's in the White House.
Linda emailed, and here's our final minute. Is it possible to recover from this widespread damage to our system?
Of course it is. We are a resilient country. But we can't recover unless we know the damage that is done. So again, that's why I wrote the book. It is to get people focused on what's happening and also get them to understand how power is distributed. I said that Trump shows us our vulnerabilities, or Trump's campaign and his presidency. I think we should be talking about what to do with the Electoral College. I also think we should be talking about whether we can in the future have a better oversight of our cabinet and of the administrative state, so that it plays out more in the public eye rather than with the secrecy and the behind the scenes maneuvers, which are very, very powerful, very transformational, but often not things that we are aware of as working people, as ordinary Americans. So there's a lot for us to wrap our heads around. At this point, though, the critical thing, I would argue, is, you know, yes, pay attention to Donald Trump, but extend your attention out to look at all the things that are happening around him.
Well, John, I hope you will be coming back to Wisconsin Public Radio to talk about these issues and more, as this will probably be the last time that you and I talk about these issues.
I regret that this is the last time for that, but
you
I
will
look
be
forward
back here
to seeing you.
Yeah, thanks very much. John Nichols is the author of Horsemen of the Trumpocalypse. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.